This evening we begin a series of excursions into high legendary. And perhaps we might take a moment to introduce the general theme. As you probably well know, most of the sources of our knowledge of the great religions of the world are historically uncertain. We find that even in religious and philosophical systems that have come into existence in the last 1,000 years, data is seldom adequate. Perhaps one reason lies in the fact that most of the human experiences which have resulted in an important revelation have been highly subjective to the historical person. Usually, such information was scanty. During the person's life, he was not honored, he was not recognized, he found very little place in the pages of history. But the human mind is not inclined to leave matters like this. And gradually, myth fills in where history is inadequate. Always also, there are certain tales, legends, stories that have descended from one generation to another. These have frequently been considerably amplified in the passing of time. And where a religious factor is present, the miraculous is almost always superimposed upon the meager, demonstrable facts. This is true all over the world, and it is especially true in Asia. For we know that the Asiatic mind is very highly dramatic. Many of the great legends of the world have come from the East. And even those which we normally associate with the West may have had Oriental origins. Legends are wonderful ways of maintaining human interest in events which in themselves may be difficult or remote in time. So this evening we are going to study a fragment of the great transition which occurred in the descent of the Buddhistic tradition in the Far East. The Southern school of Buddhism, depending largely upon the Pali texts, has been termed the conservative school. Legends have arisen there, but they are few, and for the most part are held within the severity of what the Southern Buddhists believe to be the canonical writings. The Southern Buddhists depend almost entirely upon the earliest texts, and these, as might be expected, are the least embellished. Also, in the case of Buddhism, and a good parallel will be found in Christianity, actually Buddha left no written words that we are able to discover. As in most religious situations, the early perpetuation was by oral tradition only, and the Southern school takes it for granted that the earliest traditions, the earliest oral records, must necessarily be the most accurate. There may be considerable space for disagreement on this point, however. We are not sure that this is actually true, because these early records sometimes lack perspective. They represent highly localized points of view. We have, therefore, a parallel again with the Christian problem. The early Christian records are divided sharply into two groups. The records assumed to have been left by the apostles, the original group of disciples, and a rather different record, which arose from the convictions of St. Paul. Pauline Christianity was quite different in many ways from the original revelation as it has come down to us. So we naturally ask the question, what was the source of the information of St. Paul? Why did he differ from the so-called gospel narratives in so many details? The answer appears to be that Paul had access to material which has not generally survived. He had the possibility of talking with others, of observing the reactions, not of the 12, but of the stranger, of those who had only been beholders and not participants in the great Christian drama. From some point of view, either within himself or from circumstances, Paul grasped a structure that was more or less overlooked or ignored or even perhaps denied by those who were the closest of the apostles. The same thing happened in Asia. And perhaps the best way we can unfold this little story is to follow the legends, at least for a part of the way. In the northern school, the sutras, or records of the teachings of Buddha, are divided into two groups. The early records belonging to the southern school are acknowledged. They are affirmed to exist, and they are still the foundation of all that was built upon them. The northern school, however, claimed to possess other records, that in one way or another, there had descended to them further instruction, arising also in the original words of Buddha, not merely in commentary, but in actual discourses which the great teacher gave. The northern school, therefore, divided the teachings of Buddha into a series of periods. They said that Buddha, at different times in his life, revealed different levels or layers of his instruction. It is said of Jesus that he taught the multitude in parables, but to the disciples he taught certain other things. Christendom does not know what those certain other things were. There seems to have been no descent in record. In Buddhism, the certain other things which Buddha may have taught are at least claimed to have been preserved. In the course, therefore, of the ministry of Buddha, beginning with the Prajnaparamita Sutra, his instruction is regarded as having become gradually more deep and more complete. And that as he passed along through his 45 years of earthly ministry, there were occasions when to those peculiarly wise or remarkably venerable, he gave other instructions. And upon these other instructions, the Northern School is built. These other instructions have been very bewildering to Western Orientalists. During the 19th century, when nearly all writers on Buddhistic matters were either military men stationed in India, merchants, travelers, or missionaries, there was a great fondness for the Southern school. The peculiar severity of the doctrine, its profound skepticism, and the vestiges which seemed to linger in the Southern belief, affirming that Buddha was atheistic, and also that he did not believe in the immortality of the human soul. These thoughts were quickly and eagerly grasped by the missionaries. It provided them with a splendid armament against Buddhism as far as Western thinking was concerned. They were in a position to contrast the best of Christianity with the worst of Buddhism and came up with some very dramatic, if not entirely realistic, conclusions. In any event, we are indebted mostly to these doubtful sources, some of them highly obviously prejudiced, for our Western concept of this Eastern philosophy almost to the time of the turn of the present century. Actually, of course, our knowledge of the whole matter in the West was probably only 200 or 300 years old, as far as any effort at scholarship or estimation could be concerned. As a result of this mass of early publication, highly critical, an attitude was established in the Western mind, an attitude that was not especially sympathetic. What these same scholars were very reluctant to bring forth was the Northern School. They would rather not discuss that at all. For in the Northern School, the similarities between Buddhism and Christianity increased very rapidly. In the Northern School, most of the concepts which the prejudiced 19th century German and English writers had brought forward were either contradicted or nullified. Thus, it was not considered especially discreet to bring them up. Certainly not until a more modern, comprehensive grasp of Oriental philosophy was available. Many of the conditions have been corrected in the last 50 years, but the old prejudices linger on, and it is sometimes extremely difficult to uproot them. In the Mahayana system, the most important of all of the sutras of Buddha was the so-called Last Revelation. This is supposed to have occurred in the final assembly of Buddha and his arhats prior to the Parinirvana. At this time, the Buddha, having reached that period in his life's ministry in which he knew that his earthly mission was very nearly completed, felt impelled, according to the reports, to reveal the soul of the doctrine. That part which had been previously either completely concealed or at least only intimated to a few of his closest followers. A somewhat parallel account to this, of course, running very consistent with it, is the report as to the origin of Zen, which is also attributed directly to Buddha, in a special occasion in which he transmitted the doctrine by nonverbal means to one of his disciples who became the first patriarch of Zen. So there are legends and myths about these things. How true they are, perhaps we can never fully be certain. But they are not more numerous, nor more extraordinary, nor more exceptional than those which also gathered around the early centuries of Christianity. And for that matter, they are to be found in the cradle years of every religious system. The great revelation which Buddha is supposed to have made is contained in the Saddhama Pundarika Sutra, called the Sutra of the Lotus of the Good Law. This sutra, presumably, must have been transcribed by some person present, or perhaps carried in verbal descent for 2 or 3 or more generations. Again, the details are not certain, but the point that is made of really practical importance is that this sutra was never revealed. It was held either in a very small group, or else it was communicated privately. Or perhaps by even another approach, this might have been the only instruction which he personally wrote down and therefore was able to control the future of it. These are speculations. There are no certainties. The nature of the Sutra of the Lotus of the Good Law is quite suggestive of the Apocalypse of St. John. It is entirely different from practically any other early Buddhist writing. Many others descended from it, but this has an almost unique place in itself. In this sutra, the instruction is primarily attributed to Buddha. It is in the usual form, except that it exists in two parts. The first, prose, and the second, gatha. Gathas are poems. They are poetic renditions of sermons or great instructions. Gathas are also to be found in Persian religion, and it is held on some grounds that perhaps they were introduced into India by Persians. As a result of the two forms, the Sadhana Pundarika Sutra is really two books in one, with the texts exceedingly similar. It is as though you read a prose and then a poetic version of the same statements. Some sections are not in Gatha. They exist only in the prose form. But these are only about four or five out of the nearly 30 sections which make up the work. We say that the tone of the volume, or the tone of the instruction, is apocalyptical, that it is a great drama, an incredible unfolding in space. It has high majesty. It is entirely different in tone and in quality from the severe, highly moralistic doctrines of the Southern school. These doctrines are not contradicted, but they are expanded in a very curious way, one which has hardly been touched by Western thinkers at all. Only a few Orientalists have worked with it carefully. A fair version of the Lotus Sutra will be found in Max Müller's collection of the Sacred Books of the East. The general theme presents us with a series of new patterns, which may be regarded as essentially esoteric. Certainly, they are highly mystical. Buddha is transformed in this sutra from the moral teacher who walked the dusty roads of Bengal to a symbol of universal reality. Buddha is transformed much as Jesus was transformed by Paul. The historical Jesus of the apostles and the mystical Christos of Paul. The Christos was a universal being, an ever-present power, a majesty in space. And to a large measure, this is what happens in the Lotus Sutra. Buddha is the axis of it. He is a strangely detached axis. In the sutra, there is no warm humanity bestowed upon the Buddha personality. He is completely detached from all worldliness. And yet with it, there is this tremendous sense of the divine presence. Several authorities have come to the conclusion that in the Lotus Sutra, Buddha is lifted to a condition or position very close to divinity. And yet he is not divine. The sutra makes no effort to indicate that he is. In this sutra, Buddha becomes, so to say, one of the great flowerings of mankind. The Buddha seed sowed in space has produced the perfect lotus of the true law. Buddha is presented as the complete graduate from the processes of evolution. He is lifted up until he becomes the personification of all virtues, until he becomes the symbol of man as infinite. He is raised to the condition in which, to the practical mind,
he could very easily become an object of worship. In fact, there is no doubt that Buddhism as a religion is founded squarely on the Lotus Sutra. Buddha seated in the midst of space becomes the axis of a drama that takes in both inconceivable time and inconceivable space. Buddha now becomes a symbol of the infinite attainment of life itself. In the Lotus Sutra, he represents mind as infinite thought, mind as eternal thought, mind unborn and undying. Not the mortal mind we know, but a strange infinite mind in which all things have an endless and enduring existence. This mind is ever changing in its appearances, ever different in its manifestations, ever moving from one integration to another, always unfolding, always growing, until the end is an absolute apocalypse. Wherever this tradition arose, it was certainly one of the most extraordinary products of man's creative skill, legendary, or dramatic power. It has been likened to the rituals of a great mystery school, something which, while passionless in itself, would create in man a tremendous passion after infinity. One of the first things that the Lotus Sutra reveals to us is that Buddha was not unique. While he represents this infinite expanse of consciousness, similar representations, equal representations, exist everywhere. The universe, as a causal, invisible realm, is inhabited by an infinite number of completely enlightened beings. These enlightened beings are all Buddhas. They abide in the most remote places of space and time. Buddhism, in this respect, drew upon the great astronomical theories of the Brahmins and conceived a universe which is not in any way put to shame by modern science. For instead of using light years to measure time or distances, the Brahmins had their own calculations. But space extended out in countless billions of aeons of time and distance. And everywhere in this space, which unfolded like the enormous rose of Dante's Paradiso, everywhere in space were these meditating powers, these vast products of ageless evolution. All of this vast mystery did not descend from heaven. It rose from nature. It was a revelation of the infinite power contained in the mystery seeds of things, the bija seeds. The seeds of Buddha are cast in space, and they continue to unfold until each one reveals its complete enlightenment. And space is filled with an evolving order of creatures, beings, powers, all in infinite unfoldment. When the time comes for the sutra to begin, it has its own delightful, dramatic beginning. The great teacher, who is now both Buddha and an infinite symbol, is quietly meditating. And around him are gathered the aeons, the powers, an infinite number of arhats with their shaven heads, extending as far as the mind can think into eternity. Here also are gathered the great regiments of the bodhisattvas in their wonderful princely habiliments. Here are the Brahmin gods from all the lokas of the ancient Hindu pantheon. Here also are the great processions of nuns, led by the wife of Buddha himself. Here are all the orders of the mendicants, the seekers, the believers. Here also, according to the artistic representations of these events in ancient fresco, are all the animal creatures, everything that lives. For this scene is a sort of infinite expansion of the Parinirvana scene. In this also, Buddha is surrounded by examples of every type of living thing. Slowly, the great teacher emerges from meditation. And from the urna, or mysterious coil of light on his forehead, breaks forth the ray that illuminates all worlds. And the great company becomes, as it were, under the spell of an absolute waitingness. The great power was to speak. But before this power spoke, the sky was filled with clouds and lights. And down from the skies in all parts of the universe came the Buddhas of other worlds, other constellations, other planets, other levels of space, all coming to join in this great moment when the law was to be revealed. Now it is well possible to imagine the power of this scene. The interpretation of it is extremely complicated. For as might be expected, the words that have been preserved and attributed to Buddha on this occasion are scarcely the secret of the situation. These words are again only veiled symbols. The obvious and evident meanings were not too clear. But out of the general sense of the meaning, out of the intimations, out of the strangely stated phrases, which are so much in the spirit of Eastern literature, there comes the gradual revelation of a total universe of light, a universe of things hidden and also of things revealed, a universe in which the mystery of the nirvana, or the extinction, or the idea that all things in Buddhist philosophy were to end in oblivion, was fragmented and dissipated. I think the point that was made, perhaps, in this discourse, at least that is one of the meanings that came to my thinking about it, was that it represented the transition of the mind from the total state of ignorance to the total state of awareness. The great concept of the cosmotheism of Buddhism, which means the cosmos itself as divinity, seems to rest upon the symbolism of the lotus. And perhaps that is why the sutra was so named. It would seem as though existence is divided into an upper and lower hemisphere. The lower hemisphere symbolized by water, and the higher hemisphere symbolized by light. From below, from the mud, from the slime, from the prehistoric origin of things, the lotus plant gradually grows upward to reach toward the light. And finally, it reaches the surface, the place where the water and the light meet. And on this surface, its blossom opens. And when its blossom opens, all of the corruption, all of the darkness, all of the mud and the slime is forgotten. For this blossom opens with absolute purity, indicating in its color and beauty no defilement of any kind. It is enlightened consciousness fed from the dark slime of ignorance. It is a very interesting and dramatic symbolism. And on it, of course, is based the concept that all Buddhas are shown seated upon lotus thrones, or the lotus is associated intimately with them. So the lotus becomes the symbol of the bursting open of consciousness. We have mentioned before in discussing things here that in Buddhism, the attainment of wisdom is not a direct action. It arises from the diminution of ignorance. Man becomes right by ceasing to be wrong. Right is not something attained by a direct action. Man cannot reach out and grasp truth. But when error in him ceases, truth is there. For error obscures truth. And truth can only be achieved by the consciousness outgrowing ignorance or error. When this is accomplished, man reaches the surface or the dividing point between his human consciousness and his universal consciousness. And in this we find Buddhism also borrowing something from the Vedanta and from the concept of Atman, the Hindu idea of inner reality. Just as surely as the entire meditation processes of Buddhism and the final trance state of the Arhat is very close to the concept of samadhi in more modern Hindu mysticism. In any event, what we seem to have here is that man finally reaches a state in which for the first time he is capable of knowing. That knowledge is not really unfolding step by step. Man is unfolding consciousness degree, by casting off error. But there comes a time when the scales tip, when the condition of ignorance can no longer control or hold. And in that moment, the individual passes into what might seem to him to be extinction. But it is only the final extinction of his own ignorance. It is ignorance and not man that dies. It is the three flames that go out, not the eternal flame. It is the conditioned being that ceases, the being that lives in a world of dimensions, a being whose entire existence is based upon dimension-conditioned attitudes, the being that can think of the universe only from the outside, the being that can conquer planets and remain unconquered in his own soul. But there comes this point which seems to be the burden of the Lotus Sutra, the point in which suddenly the little self dies and the self with the capital S takes over. In that moment is the beginning of man's true existence, an existence which he cannot comprehend till he attains it, an existence which, when not achieved, appears to be only a vacuum, the mystery of the void, as we find it in Chinese Buddhism. But what I think the Lotus Sutra attempts to do symbolically is to indicate something of the nature of this beyondness, this condition that arises when ignorance finally dies. And to represent it, there is the same kind of magnificent spectacle that we find in the Apocalypse of John and some of the Gnostic apocalyptic writings. Here the truth seeker, passing through the orbits of the planets, coming finally to the little door in heaven, passes through, guided by the angel, and stands in the presence of the heavenly mystery. This is also the story of Muhammad's night journey to heaven. It is a symbol of a mysterious journey, a journey from egoism to universalism, from the condition of being a person to the condition of absolute identity with absolute being. And as absolute being remains beyond our definition, no matter how mystically we may be inclined, and as the communication of it remains as the sovereign impossibility, which Buddha himself would not attempt. Therefore, it can only be presented by a vast pageantry of symbols, a tremendous explosion of light, a tremendous expansion of the very ritual that is legendary perpetuated in the story of the temptation and the enlightenment or illumination of Buddha. In that moment, the heavens opened, revealing also the tremendous hierarchy of divine powers. In the Lotus Sutra, this hierarchy is again present, infinitely magnified, attended by all who have achieved the liberation. The arhats, in all probability, symbolize the ancient pre-Buddhistic teachers. The arhats are the wise of all times, the wise of everlastingness, who in their own ages and their own worlds, but still part of humanity, at all times since the beginning of this unknown period that Buddhism does not even dare to calculate, have attained enlightenment, have come to be the meritorious, those who are justified, those who are true, a strange and wonderful order of sanctified beings. They are therefore present as part of this vast congregation. In the Lotus Sutra also we become more aware of the bodhisattvas, which become quite important in the northern school. One of the first that we come to know in the great epic is the bodhisattva Maitreya. Maitreya, of course, was the custodian and guardian of the Tushita heaven, the heaven where Buddha himself awaited embodiment. He is supposed to be the next Buddha. Therefore, he contains within his own nature the accomplishments of the Bodhisattva and the long shadow of approaching Buddhahood. We also find the princely power Manju, or Manjushri, the Lord of Wisdom. We find all this great company. And we also receive the distinct impression that what we are looking upon now in this entire aggregation is nothing but the extension of the central, seated, poised being in the midst of them. All of these extensions are manifestations of the infinite power of infinite consciousness. They are really embodiments of the central figure itself. They are the infinite reflections, as described in some of the Eastern books, where it is said that the light of one candle, reflected from an infinite number of mirrors, seems to fill space with an infinite number of lights. But there is only one true light, and all the rest is reflection. And in the great drama of the cosmotheism of the Lotus Sutra, all these lights seem to be the strange reflections of the one poised, changeless power that is in the midst of them. The result of the sutra's message, so to say, was to transform the entire concept of Buddhism. The first and most important thing that it did was to change the ancient idea of the arhat. In southern Buddhism, the arhat was a solitary sage who had departed from all worldliness and, taking the begging bowl and turning to the robe, dedicated his life to wandering in lonely isolation in search of truth. This arhat in the southern school is supposed to be merely a symbol of Buddha during the period of his own wandering in search of enlightenment. But there is one flaw which even the southern Buddhists have been forced to admit in their point of view, and that is that the arhat, by his action, does not follow in the footsteps of the Buddha. Actually, in the great Buddhistic system, the Triratna, or the three jewels, are the three great inspirations, or the three great refuges of human consciousness. They are the life of the Buddha, the teaching of the Buddha, and the association of the Sangha, or the monastic body. The arhat of the southern school went forth seeking only his own enlightenment. Buddha did not. After the temptation of Buddha, when he achieved enlightenment at Buddhagaya, and other temptations were passed, and he had brought the earth to witness that his law was true, then with another episode that was very similar to the story of the temptation of Jesus on the mount. Mara, the illusion, returned to plague the Buddha. Mara said to him, "Master, you have attained enlightenment. You are a perfect Buddha. I bow before you. I admit your authority. However, why now do you not retire into the nirvana and go into infinite rest? Why do you not fulfill the path which you have chosen to walk? Why do you remain in this world now that you are free of it and need it no longer?" This was the temptation. The Buddha resisted it, declaring that it was not his intention to go into the world as a person again, nor to retire from it to solitary eternal rest. His duty was to become the instructor of his fellow men, to go forth teaching them the Noble Eightfold Path. This further confounded Mara, the deity of darkness, for it assailed the foundations of the empire of ignorance. For while the Arhat of the Southern School sought only liberation, Buddha himself forfeited his liberation, renounced it in order to serve his fellow man. And this is a strong point which the Northern School has made, that the end of the great path is not that the individual shall seek his own peace, but that he shall fulfill the vow which, according to the Lotus Sutra, he made ages ago when he first put his foot upon this path of enlightenment, namely, that he would not seek eternal peace until he could bring with him every existing sentient being of all worlds. So this supported the Lotus Sutra point of view. For in this sutra, we now find all the Arhats, and especially the Bodhisattvas, emerging as the great compassionate ones. Here we come into the presence of Kanman, or Avalokitesvara, the great Bodhisattva of mercy. And we get a clue to something of this by the fact that Kanman, or mercy, is the embodiment of the voice of the Buddha. That it is this embodiment which brings peace in the form of words, in the form of instruction, in the form of inner consolation, and the natural graciousness of life. Wherever the kind word is spoken, the experience of the voice of the teacher is known in the world. So all of these bodhisattvas are again only conditions. They are only stages, infinitely multiplied images of great psychological principles abiding in human consciousness and in universal consciousness. Here also we find the Buddha proclaiming a ministry that is to be taken to all parts of the universe. We find for the first time the record of the rise of Amitabha, the Buddha of the Western Paradise. And we have the glimpse of Gautama preparing to build the paradise of the East. We find the great hollow square of meditation Buddhas and a vast development of symbolism that led to the high mysticism and tantra of Northern Buddhism. Well, of course, we might say, and quite justly say, that all of this is high fantasy. But the difference that it achieved was that it made possible the dissemination of a teaching which would certainly have died without it. The lonely Arhat, wandering in search of his own perfection, deserting all, separating himself from every aspect of human existence, foregoing marriage and parenthood, leaving his business or profession, giving his goods to others, and in a desolate condition, seeking only enlightenment. This was a very abstractly noble idea, but not suitable or possible as a social state of mankind in general. It had to be limited to the Sangha, to the association of the monks, and it left the whole laity, the great world of people, without any direct participation in the mystery. We had again the same thing in Christianity. In the early days of Christianity, the laity could only serve the priesthood. They could never actually be dynamic participants in the great Eucharistic mysteries of their own faith. They were on the outside, perhaps considered, perhaps to a measure respected, but never permitted to partake of those rites which were for the sanctified, the ordained, and the venerable. This situation in Buddhism would certainly have produced the same kind of stalemate that might have arisen in Christianity without St. Paul. It was necessary to break through this and to create a new democracy in the universe. And the Lotus Sutra is probably one of the most extraordinary statements of democracy. For in it, there is a vast equality under everything else. There is infinite opportunity for all, and special privilege for none. Buddhism always had this basic concept, but it unfolded into a magnificent pageantry in the Sutra of the Lotus of the Law. Another point that we have to bear in mind is that Buddhism, unlike most other religions, was a religion of wanderers. Buddhism gradually ceased to have great authority in its own land. Between the revivals of Hinduism and of the Vedantic and Yogic sects, which came very close to Buddhism, absorbed part of it, and in turn contributed something to the Buddhist point of view, and the final ascent of Muslimism in India, the ancient faith vanished from the land. It thereby sentenced itself to a vast pilgrimage. A pilgrimage over a tremendous area, nearly all of Asia, extending down into the East Indies and over as far as Korea and Japan, upward toward the highest steppes of Siberia, and on the opposite direction all the way to Greece, Egypt, and Eastern Europe. Therefore, it had a tremendous pilgrimage among peoples of many beliefs and many faiths, among peoples who had culture and who did not have culture, to primitive tribes and proud nations. It touched with its magic the extremely primitive people of Tibet and transformed them into a highly cultured group on their own level of thinking. It also then touched a magnificent civilization such as China, which is not in any way primitive, which had its own teachers, its own leaders, which cherished Confucius and Lao Tzu, and it was able to contribute something to the great rise of Chinese, Korean, and Japanese art. All these elements meant that the faith itself had to explode almost like an apocalyptic vision and cover all of Asia, and it did so. And it was able to reach into every level of Asiatic life, as you can see even now. It touched the farmer, the common man, the humble person, the housewife, the tired mother, and the small child. It was no longer in any way a strange aloofness wandering across the face of Asia. And this transformation was almost entirely due to the revelation of the Lotus Sutra. So what happened to it? There was no record of this sutra for a long time. It apparently was not actually known until the 1st or 2nd century A.D., which would probably be 500 years after the Parinirvana of Buddha himself. And it is only fair to point out that he declared that the great period of unveiling and revelation and interpretation would begin 500 years after his death. He sensed this, perhaps knew why. But the great sutra of the good law vanished away. No one knew what happened to it. At that time, no one knew the content. They did not have the opportunity to study it in the sacred books of the East. It was then a myth and a mystery. There were rumors that it existed, but no one knew where, no one really had any good answers at all. There was a report that was preserved at Nalanda, the great university in southern India, the great center of the Buddhist tantric philosophy, that this sutra had not been entrusted to any human being at all, for fear that even the most devoted and dedicated disciple, Ananda, the keeper of the records, might be tempted, even by greatness of his own heart, to reveal this sutra before its time. It was one of these things that was timed in some way. It had to come only when the moment was right. Now, skeptics from the of the mother beliefs take a little different and not quite so friendly attitude on this. They insist that it was not preserved, that it was not kept, that it never existed, and that it was actually written at the time it was discovered. Now, this is what might be termed a very modern approach. It would be worthy of one of our higher intellectuals. But the fact remains that in the old legends, and the legends get pretty thick right now, that it was not entrusted to a human being at all, but it was entrusted to the king of the Nagas, the Nagas being the serpents. The serpents in India and in Nalanda were regarded as very strange and mysterious beings. They were always associated in both East and West with a twofold meaning. In both Asia and in the Near East, in during Bible times, the serpent was both the symbol of wisdom and the symbol of temptation or cunning. In Egypt, we find the same meaning. And we find the well-known admonition in the Bible, "Be ye wise as serpents and as harmless as doves." So the serpent had a good meaning and a bad meaning. But in almost all ancient peoples, the serpent was an esoteric emblem. It represented one of several things. First, it represented the hidden school, the secret assembly of the Mahatmas, adepts, or Bodhisattvas, or Arhats, according to your belief, who maintained for centuries the secrets of their order, awaiting the strange symbol or sign which was to indicate the day of revelation. The second symbolism of the serpent in Tantra and in northern India and Tibet and Nepal associates it with yoga, indicating the serpent power, the mysterious spinal fire within man, which when raised up bestows upon man the power of consciousness of inner comprehension. Therefore, that the serpent in this case was the guardian of the inner world, the guardian of that part of consciousness which can only be known when, perhaps to borrow another simile from the Old Testament, the brazen serpent was raised in the wilderness, and all who looked upon it lived. This mysterious type of symbolism perhaps has a bearing upon our present problem. At the great University of Nalanda, there was a tank or pool of blue lotuses which was built upon the site of the ancient habitation of the Nagas, the serpent kings. In Siam or Thailand, Buddhist figures are nearly always shown seated upon the coils of the great seven-headed Naga, the king of the Nagas, Mukalinda, who, according to the ancient legends, used his hooded cobra head to protect Buddha from all evil, forming of it a kind of canopy or guard against the entry of the evil thoughts of wicked souls. In any event, the serpent symbol was tied into the mystery of the lotus of the good law. It was said that these serpents received this as the most priceless of their heritage, that they dedicated and swore that they would maintain the secret until the coming of the messenger, the one who was appointed to reveal it. And in order that it might never be falsely revealed, they carried it into one of the most distant places of the world, Various stories are advanced as to where this distant place is. Some said that it was in the Himalayas of northern India. Some in the plains of southern India. This is the more common version. Others still that it was not in this world at all, but that the secret repository of the great wisdom was suspended in space, like the pagodas and temples that appeared in the great vision of the Blue Lotus Sutra. And around this place, this mysterious and secret abode, the Nagas spun clouds of oblivion so that no one could find it. And they guarded it day and night. And over it they held protection under the great hoods of their cobra heads. And the Nagas regarded this mysterious possession as being the symbol of the possibility of their own ultimate enlightenment. That the time would come when they too would know the mystery of the great enlightenment. So as faithful custodians, they gain merit. And there are accounts that many of the bodhisattvas or arhats at different times took upon themselves the forms of Nagas in their embodiment in order that they might become the guardians of the secret treasure. This was the treasure. No one knew exactly what the treasure was at that time. The treasure was supposed to be the living Buddha himself. And if we go a little further into it, we see why this was. Because it was held in ancient times that a sacred sutra or a book, manuscript, scroll, that contained the words of the teacher, such a document was the teacher. He took upon himself this embodiment. And the Tibetans have a deity, the Prajnaparamita deity, the God that lives in the books of truth. So this is a very interesting sidelight, namely that the book containing the instruction was identical with the teacher himself. About the 3rd century A.D., there arose a very strange man in India. Again, many historians doubt his existence. They think it was another one of those delightful figments. But then again, this was not necessarily unique. It isn't 100 years since most people did not believe Lao Tzu ever lived. And there are still authorities that insist that he is merely a composite of older beliefs. But the Chinese will never accept this point of view. And many of their records go back far enough to very much embarrass critics who are saved largely by their inability to read Chinese. In any event, this man who arose was an arhat, converted to Buddhism from Hinduism. He had been a Brahmin. This is another interesting parallel with St. Paul. Whereas many of the disciples were men of common stature, Paul was a citizen of Rome, the highest honor that a man could have at that time. As a citizen of Rome, he was, in this virtue alone, one set apart from the common herd. He was socially an aristocrat, a learned man, a scholar, a deep and penetrating thinker. And most of all, if he had lived in India, it would have been said that he was born of a high caste because of his Roman citizenship. Well, Nagarjuna, as he was called, the serpent taught, part of the tradition of the Nagas. He was a man who, in the legend that we have of him, was a magician. And like some of the great sorcerers of Tibet, he's credited with vast superhuman powers. His abilities were so numerous and diversified that he raised the dead, that he healed the sick, that he was able to travel in the air, that he could move invisibly from place to place. The legends about him are almost limitless. And each one piles further wonders upon those which have previously been heaped together. Now, apparently, Nagarjuna was the one who was waited for. He was the messenger who had been appointed. He did not know this himself, and that was quite according to Buddhism, inasmuch as Gautama did not know his own ministry until the illumination.